not too far off, right? So Ben, welcome. Ben's third talk this week, and it is, we got a little bit of it at Ben's book reading at 4 o'clock, so there are some of us that were very intrigued. So Wisdom's Buried Treasure, The Dust to Dust Eco-Theology of Green Funerals. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Sharon. Thanks for everybody being here, like the after dinner hour to discuss mortality. Let's do it. I want to start with one example of why I'm giving this talk, and it was when I was in grad school and was giving, Barbara Ross and I were both did the training with Al Gore to present like climate science stuff, and so my son's elementary school invited me to come give a child level introduction to climate change for the science class. I guess it was like everybody's in the same class at that point, and so I was giving, wanted to pitch it, talk a lot about our agency and our possibilities of mitigating climate change, and about halfway through the talk, a little girl with braids sitting cross-legged in the front row looks up with big eyes and says, "We're all gonna die." She didn't say it in like a panic loud voice, but it was just like this kind of all caps, fearful sounding thing. And so for as much as I wanted to play up the possibilities of the possibility of change and political progress, she could see where business as usual was headed. And somebody phrased it, if current trends continue, we won't. Mm-hmm. So that's one small example of a larger kind of daily phenomenon in which we are actually receiving a regular diet of apocalyptic imagery. Some of this information, including, and I'm going to bring this back around to Wisdom shortly, Wisdom and Burial. Some of this is really important and accurate. But you've probably seen these psychological studies, they often pop up at like times of war especially, that when we humans operate in a super high anxiety mode, we tend to either like retreat to passivity or scapegoat and go to violence, right? So we just aren't really, we aren't very wise when we do that. So a lot of daily reporting on climate change includes somewhere in the story this phrase, beyond which human civilization as we know it could not survive. So just think for a second, think about what that means, that we're exposed to that possibility with a kind of regularity, it even becomes numb. And then I was watching this during the presidential election campaign, these two lines figured somewhat prominently in the kind of stump speeches. So one, a man who can bait with a tweet should not have his finger on the nuclear button, and then, if Hillary becomes president, ISIS will take over this country. And I was just thinking, what does it mean that most Americans believe one of those two, some form of one of those two things, that one of those two candidates was going to take us to the edge of apocalypse? Right? Some of us may still believe that. Right? So some recent scholarly attention to this age of anxiety has renewed focus how at the heart of a lot of this cultural angst is really the old fear of death. Our own death, the death of others, the death of things that we love and cherish. So here's a pivot. Here's the pivot toward scriptural wisdom tradition. That the scriptural wisdom tradition changes the key of this psalm from this kind of panicked, all caps, we're all gonna die, to an affirmation of what it means to be a creature of earth. Instead, we're all gonna die. All flesh is grass. The grass withers, the flower falls. Human and animals, we all go to one place. All are from the dust. All turn to dust again. In other words, we're all going to die. Lowercase, right? So it's the same fact. There's a choir over there. This is going to be amazing. It's the same fact about creaturely mortality that you can either speak kind of in DEFCON 1 or in the Bible. It's a phrase of divine wisdom that's supposed to set us at peace and make us wise. So in terms of approaching the fact that everybody, every creature is dying, it's kind of the difference between framing it as like mass death, like in the Hollywood Friday the 13th movie, or like the church's Ash Wednesday liturgy. They have different effects on us. So the wisdom tradition, this is what we've been talking about this week, the wisdom tradition has this kind of surprising thing that it says, if you want to be rooted stably in the face of apocalyptic anxiety, don't try to avoid it, but rather sink your roots down into the earth of our common creaturely mortality. Go into it, right? So what I want to notice here is that the way that the wisdom tradition helps us think about death is to ensure that when we approach human mortality, this, if you've been tracking with this wisdom stuff this week, you know already, when the wisdom tradition goes after mortality, it wants to make sure the picture is large enough so that it includes all the other creatures, the grass, their return to the earth, the flowers, even mountains that eventually crumble into the sea. So the wisdom tradition considers all of that, all of the kind of the wider landscapes dying and rising. That's crucial information for us when we consider our own human mortality. Now keep that in mind as we think about some of the ways that North American death practices have bracketed all of that out, right? So part of the thesis here, what I want to say is that for Christians who are going to continue to have the doctrine, the dogma of resurrection, for that mystery and whatever it means, we're going to continue to have it near the center of our faith. The wisdom tradition says if you're going to talk about death and resurrection, you need to include the dying and rising of all the other earthly creatures made of dust and the breath of God. If you miss out on that, you won't be wise, right? So that's a scriptural imperative for us. And now I want to turn us toward this practice of green burial or natural burial. And I want to show a little bit about how I think that's embodying some of the wisdom tradition's practices, right? So the first thing I'm going to do is a little introduction to green burial. Let me do a quick just poll here. If I say natural burial or green burial, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 is first time I've heard of it, 10 is sit down, Stuart, I'm teaching from here on. Let's just popcorn out some numbers. Where are people?
5, 4, 3, 1, 7, 6.
Okay, yeah, good. Okay, so cluster kind of around the middle. Good, okay, helps. So here are some just recent headlines about this, like that you might have seen in the news, right? I want to talk about this trend that's been popping up, an idea that instead of sprawl, you can become a forest. They're catching on. I'll show you the trailer for a film that's been getting some attention. And one way you can think about natural burials, somebody asked me, Sharon, you said, tell me how do I know it in 30 seconds. Here we're going to talk about three key practices, three focal practices that distinguish natural or green burial. How we care for the body, what we put that body in, or the cremated remains in, and how we commit it, return it to the earth or the elements. Okay? So I'm going to structure this kind of main section around those three different things and show some distinctions around it. So first is care for the body. And this is kind of an easy one because the main key distinction here is the refusal to use chemically toxic formaldehyde and ethanol-based embalming fluids to preserve the body. And if you look up here, these are actually embalming fluids. That's a real title, Permaglow. Isn't that?
Yeah.
I love it.
Restore it.
Yeah. Dream on.
Restore it.
So the formaldehyde that's used in this has been linked to cancer and other diseases. It may be the cause of elevated rates of leukemia and brain cancer that's found among embalmers and pathologists. Well, side note, to be honest, we don't know how much this stuff is invading groundwater supply. There's a lot of it. But the biggest concern in the green fume is really what it does to the people who are using these chemicals. And it's proven. We already know that that's happening. It is true, though, the average U.S. cemetery has enough to fill like a backyard swimming pool of this stuff in it. Right? So while some natural burial practitioners will use non-toxic embalming chemicals that aren't, you know, these kind of toxic chemical based, most don't. And our bodies, depending on the climate, temperature, things like that, usually can stay around for about 3 days before you kind of get a sense it's time to return this body to the earth. And what often people do will just keep a body on dry ice, and it keeps the body cool in a way that's okay. Sometimes you can also just go to have a body refrigerated at the morgue or the funeral home.
May I ask a quick question? Sure, please. When did the practice of embalming in that way?
Yeah,
that
Civil War, U.S. U.S. Civil War, when bodies were dying in places outside of their home, and we had railroads, right? And so people they didn't want to bury it in enemy territory. So they'd bring him back. And then what really kicked it off was Abraham Lincoln's death. And when his body, if you remember, went on the train, and people were like, this is possible. And then the chemical industry actually is what started the embalming industry, and they kind of propped that up. It also came along with like lots of fears about urbanization and disease. So it got associated as being a kind of a health practice, but there's no, it actually is probably more unhealthy. Most of what gets drained out of the body still today goes into like a storm sewer, actually. So a little queasy, just trigger warning on that. In the natural burial movement, what happens instead of that chemical embalming is often the way you might have, you might contract with a doula or a midwife, and you have a birth plan. You have a death plan with someone who, an end-of-life doula or an end-of-life midwife, who will walk you through this and train you and help you do the things that many people, our ancestors used to know, how to lay out, wash a body, and prepare them for burial. Side note, the people who used to do this actually were often midwives. They would bring bodies into the world, and they would also help lay out bodies when they had died. And credentialed, scientifically oriented men took over both processes at about the same time.
Right? Interesting.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so, yeah.
Just really quick, is there license or like certifications or programs for
so interesting that you would say that. Here are okay. Four organizations that offer some kind of services, either a training or you can just get in touch with them and say, hey, I'd like to have a end-of-life midwife come with, you know, to help us support in this process. Or they themselves may just do the conferences or that they'll train. Yes?
In Judaism, don't they have a practice of
washing?
Yeah, we'll get to, absolutely. Yeah, it's wonderful. And I should also say about embalming, I didn't know this, actually, until I had done a good deal of research about this. The United States is actually, besides Australia, the only country where embalming is the norm on Earth, right? Most people don't do this. So we're quite strange. One other thing that's changed that the natural burial movement is aware of, I like it as a worship professor, they're attentive to the ritual environment of the place of death. So my wife works in a great urban hospital. She's studying to get her doctorate in this kind of Western medicine, and yet, we just need to be honest and thank God for its gifts, right? It saved the lives of many people that I love. But this is now the ritual environment in which most Americans die. Mm-hmm. Whereas it used to be not that long ago, it would be in a house, in a bed, surrounded by family and friends, of course, right? So the medical community is coming around to, many of you are probably aware of this book, to wrestle with these questions of what does it mean that Western medicine thinks of the process of dying almost always as just a defeat. You just end up giving up. You got to fight, right? So we're attentive to the ritual environment of where we care for the body before death and after death. I'm just going to highlight a few of these. These are on the big old bibliography I just gave you. But Vine Deloria reminds us here that this natural way of caring for bodies in death. It's not some new thing that got invented in the Green Burial Movement. It's the way all of our ancestors used to do it, and for many of us it had deep spiritual significance. This book I really recommend, Rosemary Ruther's book, because it helps tease apart some problematic trajectories we got into in Christianity that associated just being mortal with sinfulness. And so that death in some ways becomes something ashamed and always to fight against or, quote, unnatural. And we lost the wisdom tradition of Ash Wednesday, right? That somehow we bracketed that out. In Christian tradition, there's this amazing set of practices, art, scripture texts, around caring for the dead body of Jesus Christ, right? So you picture the woman at Bethany who anoints Jesus ahead of time for his death. How Nicodemus cares for the body. He's got that 100-pound backpack of spices that he's coming to lay out and care for the body, laying in a garden tomb. And then, of course, the women on Easter Sunday are coming to the tomb to care for Jesus' body. So for Christians, this practice of laying out a body, washing it, anointing it, clothing it, can be an ongoing act of care for the body of Christ, each of us members of it. There are also a lot of connections to the imagery of baptism. So in baptism, we wash someone, say they're dying and rising with Christ, we anoint them with oil, and we wrap them in a new white robe. And the same thing happens to people in baptism. Washing, anointing, clothing. And here are the these very interfaith connections that we were talking about, right? Islamic care for the dead includes washing and shrouding the body for burial by a small group of people who are selected by the family. It's considered a great honor to have that done, usually segregated by gender. They have this beautiful tradition that says...
So do both genders do it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but at different times?
No. If women wash and anoint women, men wash and anoint
God.
Men.
Oh, God. Okay.
And tradition there that says, they tell people, they take it seriously, honor the body in a way that says, if you see something that seems like strange to you, no matter what you see of a person in their vulnerability, you're sworn, you take that to your grave. And in both Islam and Judaism, there's a sense that in many ways, this is an act of care for the poor, because all of us are at our most vulnerable and impoverished in death. And so we bestow great honor on these bodies that are in need of dignity. And this is the Jewish synagogues often have a Hevra Kadisha, a holy society which passes on these traditions. Here are some images, actually, of this recovery of a ritual bathing of a body. And here's the rabbi who's talking about what we do with the body at the end of life is very much like what we do with a child when it's born, including washing the body and swaddling it in clean cloth. So this set of practices, you've seen some ancient or like older religious traditions. I want to show that actually in North American death practices, even while the green burial movement is really blossoming, our cultural practices around death in some ways are headed in the opposite direction. So here's from a USA Today article. Let's see. Have you heard this? Like life celebrations? Many of our churches are calling funerals life celebrations. In fact, it was invented by atheists to distinguish themselves, interestingly, from Christian funerals. That's just an interesting note to put there. But here's some from this article. Krem Hansen once recreated a casino inside his Phoenix funeral home where mourners, in honor of the departed, played slot machines. The idea was to create noise and activity of gambling, and the money dropped into the slots went to the deceased's favorite charities. This is from a New York Times article about the same phenomenon. As more families choose cremation, close to 70% in some parts of the West, or more like 80 now, services have become less somber because there's not a dead body present. Quote, this is the funeral director, quote, "The body's a downer, especially for boomers. If the body doesn't have to be there, it frees us up to do what we want. You may want to go to the country club or a bar or a favorite restaurant. That's where consumers want to go." So if you watch some of these trends, there's a real sense of caring for consumers and removing any sense of sadness or mourning and just celebrating a person's life. I think the model is largely on a kind of celebrity tribute. And, you know, I've got a strong critique of this, but I also want to say kind of pastorally, this is the way our culture has given us to honor people. We haven't really seen a lot of other alternatives. It's what we have before us, right? People are doing the best they can, right? So here are some trends in modern American memorial services. You just think about the way some of these relate to body and earth. It's a personalized event, not a familiar ritual. Like when I teach the funeral rite, this is the ritual we do so that we know what to do when someone dies. People want something new every time now with a funeral. Many days after death, often because of cremation. The body of the cremated remains is often not present, and maybe it's not welcome at all, right? It's a downer, as the guy said. The return to earth of a body or the cremated remains sometimes just doesn't happen. The cremated remains may remain in a closet somewhere, or it gets done only by a small group of people, oftentimes for very understandable reasons. Or it gets minimized, right? And the emphasis is on the particular life of the deceased, not a reflection on what does it mean to be a mortal creature. But at funerals, the kind of cultural trend is, what's particular about this person and how can we honor that? And I was, that's actually a really important Christian emphasis in the way we do our funerals. Every individual deserves, this is a child of God, uniquely created. So we want to celebrate their life. But that's not all we want to do. And then the emphasis is on life, not death. Often you don't really want to talk about death. They're still with us here in our hearts and things like that. We want to remember them as they were alive. And the emphasis is on celebration, not mourning. So on many of these counts, natural burial moves in the opposite direction. Not everyone, right? And it includes many of these things, like an emphasis on the life of the deceased, but it's going in a different direction. The body is important, right, and meaningful, and we want to carry it. So that's the section on care for the body, and I wanted to show how, in some ways, that distinction finds its way throughout the whole funeral process. So now let's take a look at the burial vessel. So, and first we can just say, this is, in the green burial movement, people almost always have these like memorized. Typical American cemetery, enough coffin wood for 40 houses, 1,000 tons of casket steel, 20,000 tons of vault concrete, and look at the way these get marketed, right? Bronze, a semi-precious material, is the strongest and longest lasting of any casket construction material. Bronze is resistant to corrosive elements. And many of these, the premium caskets that are marketed in words that say, this is the way you can honor your loved ones, have higher prices and are more resistant to returning to dust, right? And again, this is the cultural way we've been given to honor each other, right? So there's a throwaway line in Jessica Mitford's book, The American Way of Death, that she says, Americans, as they navigate this passage of death, navigate it in a lot the way that they choose to navigate roads. And it kind of has a comparison between caskets and our automobiles. And it's made me think about, in my leafy, boring suburban neighborhood, people who have, not everybody who drives these does this, you know, this is not a blanket generalization. Many people have a kind of fearful view of the world. The world is a violent place, and I need to be protected. Even in this leafy suburb, drive these enormous SUVs to tennis practice and back. They look made for the jungle, right? But they want to go also in luxury and like climate control. Is the same thing true about the fearful passage of death? Is that part of what happens with these kind of SUV coffins? All right, so let's just have a little fun with the SUV idea. This is one. This is California cruising caskets. There's more. It has an insert that you can use as a cooler in advance if you want to pick that up. This is actually a coffin you could get. The Star Trek casket. Which one is that? When Spock dies. Is it Khan rather than Khan? Trekkies. This is not intentionally so, but this is another coffin that like what is going on here? Sometimes when I give these natural burial talks, I'll say, why do so many coffins look like space capsules? Where are we going? Right? Are we returning to the Earth or somewhere else? In the natural burial movement, this is much more common, a plain pine box with handles. And there's already, even in its construction, there's often a lot of spirituality around it. So I'm going to show you about a 3 or 4 minute video of a guy not far from here who has a kind of spirituality of building coffins. All right? And it is a little dark. It's kind of made that way. Dark texture.
The first coffin I ever built was for my my child when my wife had a miscarriage. It took me a while to figure out how to make the panels wide and make them pretty. It's such a personal thing to have your hands on there and to really be working with it. Coffin making seems to have really begun with furniture makers. Metal is a pretty recent innovation, and apparently now we use enough metal every year in our coffins to rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge buried in the ground. To build an entire casket takes me about 25 hours. Mostly what I do is sand. I feel like I sand, and I sand, and I sand. I never feel like it's finished. But then I guess that's kind of a fit thing, because that's probably how we feel at the end of our lives too. I think one of the most important aspects of the coffin is that it can be carried. And I think we're meant to carry each other. And I think carrying someone you love and committing them is very important for us. And when we deal with death, we want to know that we have played a part and that we have shouldered our burden. So if we make it too convenient, then we're depriving ourselves of a chance to get stronger so that we can carry on. When I'm out here by myself early in the morning or in the middle of the night or something like that, I can get a sense of how work is love made visible. You know, the Benedictine monks say, work and pray. And I guess those things kind of bleed together for me. So it's not that I have some words in my head. It's more just a state of love and only a small part of a bigger picture that I don't fully understand. I'm doing something for someone that people tend to think is a destination. People think that the grave is the end. And I'm trying to eliminate that, no, it's a doorway.
So I feel like we could unpack so many of the images he used there for like a half hour, right? The shouldering burdens, the unfinished nature, the need to stand, the way we carry each other. He does this as his own kind of vocation. As I head up to the Boundary Waters, I pass the North Shore Folk School in Grand Marais, and you can take it on as your vocation there. You can take a class in this, and the tuition covers all the materials, and you can make a coffin for yourself, or my wife vetoed this idea that we'd have a coffin waiting around for me now that I'm done growing. But apparently this was not that uncommon, that when we stopped growing, we would build coffins for ourselves, right? So at $700, you can have your own made out of natural materials. But here are some other images. Some are these woven types out of reeds and types of bamboos. In the industry, they'll call these basket caskets. Kind of beautiful. But you get a really strong sense that this is about returning to the earth. There's no sense of this is going to resist corrosive elements. This is another, in places where Orthodox Jews are buried in coffins, they'll often actually even drill holes in the bottom because they want to embrace as fully as possible earth to earth, dust to dust. You can either use a shroud or a quilt or a sheet of your own, so it can become quite simple. Some of you may know about this. The monks at New Millery Abbey, Iowa, manage a sustainable woodlot, and they build these kind of coffins. And in the miracle of the internet, these Trappists, you can go online and order one anywhere in the U.S. and have it there in 3 days. And part of what one option is, it's kind of, to me, it's a beautiful tension between what endures and what returns to the earth. You can have them put on these inset crosses that when it's time to commit the coffin to the grave, the wood can come out, and then it stays as this enduring connection to the beloved, to the deceased, in your where you live, while the coffin goes into the ground. And for every coffin that they build, they plant another tree in their woodlot. People have used them and have been really very happy with the way that they've even sent notes and said, we're praying for you. For the academics, here's one that you can kind of pre-function with a bookshelf. And, yeah, when it's time, you can take the shelves out. I showed this one to the divinity school, and a professor there said, I'm going to do that. And I said, yeah, right. And I went back a few years later, and she she has it, and she's actually done calligraphy of the psalms all around the coffin now. You can think about the piety. Many Christians will talk about the piety. Jesus was buried in a shroud, and that's often the way it starts. People having these biblical images of it, how simple that is. Many Christian monks and nuns are still buried in their habits, right, into the ground. The simplicity of these vessels, Dorothy Zola says, is kind of like the beautiful simplicity of Job. Naked I came into this world, naked I go out of this world. And it's there's even, I would say, kind of a Lutheran edge to that. That the last journey we will take, the final journey we will take, will not be under our power. We will be carried by others, by God, by grace, in our final journey to the grave.
Ben, that's really, because anybody could lift that compared to, I mean,
like... Well, yes, right. You don't have to get the macho people to do this. Right. And think about Luther's, they're not maybe his last words that he spoke. He probably wrote it. But in the end, we are beggars. This is true. Like, everything comes to us as a gift. So we'll be carried to the grave. That vessel, whatever it is, in Christian churches is often draped with that one more reminder of baptism, this beautiful funeral pall. Some people, I imagine, have these in your churches. It can cover a really ostentatious coffin and say equal, baptismal equality. It can cover a very inexpensive coffin or a shroud. Equal. We are all shrouded and clothed in God's grace. And then, so that's as much as I'm going to do on the vessel. Now I'm going to turn to to the committal to the earth. And I want to give, this is an image of when I was just mentioning this sabbatical hike that I went on in the Smokies, where I spent a month praying and hiking by myself among these 150 or so backcountry cemeteries. And these are mostly about 100-year-old cemeteries that some of the ancestors still continue to take care of. And so I put this up here for a couple reasons. One is that natural burial is not new. These people were all just lowered in the ground in shrouds or in simple wooden boxes. And they're surrounded by utter natural beauty in a protected area. And also, I was stunned by the way, over and over, these places, this is obviously during midday here, these stones all face east, face the direction of the rising sun. It's this ancient Christian practice of anticipating the dawn of each new day and the dawn of God's new day, that God will hold us in the dawn of a new day. So I just wanted you to see that this is not something new. In contrast, we've developed in North America, I didn't even know about these until I started researching, burial vaults. And so most of our coffins are kind of like the inside piece of a Russian nesting doll. You put this inside another box, right? And the advertising on this, once again, says if you really want to honor people, you keep out the corrosion. And famously, one of the advertisements for one of these vaults advertise that there's a 1,200-pound lid, a rubber gasket, and, quote, this is your last line of defense against Mother Nature. Fight to the end, and for sure you're going to lose. And people who run cemeteries will tell you the reason these are here has nothing to do with public health. It has to do with so the ground won't sink when things biodegrade, so you can mow, basically. These are the stats on kind of the every year U.S. This is kind of just projecting out what we've seen before. 30 million board feet of timber, 90,000 tons of steel, 1.5 million tons of concrete, almost 1 million gallons of that embalming fluid. And then over the top of that, you're going to treat it with mowing, pesticides, and weed killers. Mark Harris, whose book I put on there, one of the earliest books on natural burial in recent decades, has this kind of provocative image. He said, are we burying people in cemeteries in the ground, or are we burying people in landfills? Because most of what's under the ground is basically garbage. That's a strong, like, provocative image. And again, like, I always, at some point in this talk, always want to say, like, my wife knows what I want to have done, and she knows how strongly I feel about this, but I always say to her, if Christianity teaches us anything, it is that a death that looks God-forsaken, and like the last thing that we want, and utterly polluted, God holds us in mercy even in that death. So, if you need, Beth, to, when I die, pump me full of chemicals, put me in an SUV coffin, and put me inside of a vault. It's okay. I understand that God's mercy holds me there, right? I think that's something of Christianity, right? That's what we teach.
Ben, do cemetery associations have the freedom to have vaults or not have vaults? Or are there state regs that...
This is great. So there is no state, listen to this, there is no states in our dear country where there are vaults required. You will hear differently, but it's not true. And on your book, or in your bibliography, what I'd recommend to you is kind of the Bible on this stuff, is a book called Final Rights, R-I-G-H-T-S. And it goes state by state and says, what are the state policies? There's a whole lot of stuff that you need to attend to sometimes. But embalming is not required in any state, and neither are vaults. Cemeteries sometimes will require them. And then what happens sometimes for Jews, they'll sometimes do this compromise where they'll allow them to take one of the vaults and flip it upside down so that they can rest on the ground, but then the earth won't settle, right?
Where is Final Rights in here? Is there an author?
Josh Slocum and...
Okay.
Is it under Slocum? Is that the
Slocum,
first one?
Okay. Yes.
And there are also some websites on there that have even more slightly up-to-date information on state-to-state stuff. But the general rule is there's way more that's kind of allowed than is not allowed.
Could you make the argument that the vaults keep the embalming fluid out of the water table?
Well, eventually we'll get there, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but think about if you wanted to be sanitary with a body, would you put it into the ground in the area of decomposition that's most healthy for it, or would you put it inside a number of places where there's this air around there in which there's more access, actually, to that if you can get inside that vault, which often you can. So things get kind of weird. Yeah. And there's no evidence that it is more sanitary. In fact, if those places get flooded, that's the big problem. That's when you see coffins floating down rivers. It's because they're in a vault. The water gets in and they pop up and then float down the river. So instead, was that another question? That was just somebody saying gross or something. Okay. So I'm going to show you a few different ways that the committal to the earth happens in natural burial. And this is kind of an image of what's called a hybrid cemetery. So there's the vaults and the regular coffins and the embalming happening in, maybe throughout the whole cemetery. And then if you want to choose, or maybe there's a special section, there's a natural or green area. And so in there, there'll be nobody embalmed. You'll have a plain pine box. There's no vault. And the earth will just be mounded up over that place. But otherwise, they'll be mowing across the top. Probably takes them a little extra effort to kind of keep making sure that the mound of dirt, to fill it up as it sinks. But that's one. That's called the hybrid model. And then in America, the United States, most people think, when you think of green burial, or like what's an environmentally responsible burial, most people are thinking cremation. And partly because we're going to obviously take up a lot less space. So in the green burial movement, it's actually considered a kind of middle-of-the-road option. Partly because we still use fossil fuels most of the time for that burning. And then actually, you'll see later, counterintuitively, the space you take up in death may actually be good for the earth, right? We'll get to that in a bit. But this is one environmentally responsible way to do it. And biodegradable urns, scattering on the ground or in the water, columbaria, many churches have a place for keeping ashes. And so the cloud of witnesses is still here with you even in worship. Or here, I love this. This is a columbarium surrounding this beautiful kind of grassy labyrinth so that as you walk the labyrinth, the cloud of witnesses is all around you. But kind of the one that's considered most green. Oh wait, I want to put one more caveat here. Suzanne Kelly, whose book Greening Death is on there, she says we should stop calling it cremation, what we do now. She says it's industrial incineration. And she's drawing out the kind of philosophical problems and underpinnings that in North America, she says, we're getting to the point where we're worried about the fleshiness of a body. And I interpreted her work as kind of like, we treat the dead like they're zombies and they have to be killed again. So you either purify them by putting these chemicals in their bodies, or you stop the decomposition by burning them. And she's really interested in understanding our bodies as fertile, part of the fertile earth that we return to, that our cemeteries become resurrection gardens, at least in that biological sense, right? So that's one other reason that people ask questions about cremation. Does it help us think that we're, does it make us phobic about the fertility of the earth? So here's what's considered kind of the most green, which is called conservation burial. And so what happens here is you take the legal protections of a cemetery and combine it with a nature preserve, right? So the way it often works is, here will be this protected area, and maybe somebody right on the edge of it wants to build a Walmart. And instead of that, you can say, actually right beside that preserve, we're gonna put in a natural burial ground. And so you start putting in bodies there, and it's very hard to build a Walmart. You're gonna get locked up in court for a number of reasons. Often it gets combined with a land trust. It often is accompanied with a really profound sense of spirituality, that your final act of life is to give something back to the earth and to future generations. It's given us so much beauty, so much love and life, that our last act can be a way of offering a gift to future generations. So I'm going to show you this trailer from a documentary on natural burial on a specific guy. And it actually is part of his return to Christianity. That doesn't show up in the trailer. One thing you should know, you'll see him kind of dancing at one point. And what's happened is, a guy, he's commissioned somebody to build his coffin out of reclaimed barn wood, a local guy, and he's going to visit it for the first time, and he's dancing on his coffin. Right? It's an act of spirituality. So here we go. His name's Clark. So in that documentary, he's actually able to convince a kind of conventional cemeterian not to knock down a whole tract of forest and to start a natural burial area. Right? Some places begin as intentionally conservation burial grounds, and these are some of them. This one on the upper left is Honey Creek Woodlands in Georgia, which is the largest Christian Roman Catholic burial in Conyers, Georgia. And I think the rest of these I'd be in South Carolina. So one of the kind of stunning images for me is, because trees become so important in these places, the Christian symbolism of the tree of life. You know this theologically, biblically, that this image of Jesus dying on the cross gets inverted from what's in Deuteronomy. Cursed is the one who hangs on the tree, right? That you're under God's curse if you're crucified. The line after that says, cursed is the one who hangs on the tree. You shall not pollute the land that the Lord your God has given you. So there's this idea that not only is the one who hangs on the tree under God's curse, but the land around it is also polluted. So, and it's this ugly, awful death, right? But Christianity says that, that death has shown God's solidarity with us in our polluted deaths, where we can't seem to get things right, where we might expect God's vengeance and curse. Well, instead, what happens is the cross becomes the tree of life. And in a lot of Christian imagery, that tree of life is in the Garden of Eden. You can see here a four-branch stream. Art historians know a four-branch stream in Christian art. It's the Garden of Eden. Right? This is from a 12th century church of San Clemente at Rome. And I'm going to pull, first of all, we're going to zoom in here to the deer at the four-branch stream. And it's the most, look at that image. What you can see here is all the people, probably local people from the town and animals and other creatures, are taking shelter under the tree of life, which is the cross, God with us in our sufferings and death. Right? It's the most prominent piece of art in the entire church there. Right? So planted on polluted ground, the cross makes even the polluted earth sprout and grow and give us a sign of God's promise of the restoration of the earth. And one place that's done this really dramatically, like in America, most places that do conservation burial, it's in a place that's already beautiful and pastoral. The largest burial ground in England is run by the Church of England. And what they did is they took an area that had been completely deforested, ugly, and the first thing they did was plant, I think it's 20,000 little whips, little trees, and left open those glades that you see there, and said, who wants to come be part of something that's going to be a forest in 100 years from now? And so many people responded, they doubled the size of the project. And to me, it's been really powerful that people have signed up to an area where the ground looks crucified. And they're saying, I want to be part of this process. I want to be part of God's healing and restoration of this land. Right? So some more, I just want to show you a few images before I do it. A little bit more on wisdom. I think these images speak so profoundly. This is Catherine Disher, who was buried in South Carolina at Ramsey Creek, one of the most important conservation burial grounds. You can see people reading scripture, casting flowers and earth onto the body, even young people. And I should say, like, it's very true. This is often very hard. It's like visceral. Episcopal priest I interviewed who talked about this said, there is nothing worse than the sound of the first shovel full of earth hitting a coffin, the worst sound in the world. And so much of that stuff is visceral here. You really feel it. But it doesn't end with the first shovel full. Almost always at these natural burial sites, everybody, if they want to, can help participate in closing the grave, right? And not only that, but by the time you get to the end, often what happens is you mound up the earth and you plant right there local trees and shrubs in the burial mound. Suzanne Kelly does a riff on imagining these mounds of earth as like the earth in gestation, like a pregnant mound of the earth getting ready to birth something new.
When the native people had mounds, Ben, were those bodies down in the ground, or were they in the mounds?
I don't know about all the different mound building cultures. I do know, I spent some time with the Cherokee in my backpacking trip right there in the Smokies, and their practice was east-facing burials, and they were, I don't think they were mounds, but the burial also had them facing east, facing the sunrise, and also a little inclined, as if they're ready to walk toward the sunrise. So I don't know that much about the mound cultures. The grave markers are often kind of found field stones that might be carved. some of the most cutting edge stuff. There's only one place I know of in the United States right now that does that is kind of reimagining cremation outside of fossil fuels. But this is in Colorado, this place with this stunning outdoor wood-fired cremation. And there are so many people who want to do it, they had to limit it only to people who live in this community. But you can see there, everything's kind of out in the open in a really powerful way. But for those of us who practice cremation, this is my church. We're like a couple blocks from Wrigley Field. But even there, we have had times at Sunday processed at the end of Eucharist with the processional cross in front of us with the ashes of one of our members who's died. And we have the committal rite right there in the same place where we have our summertime coffee hours. And so, like, my kids know when, you know, we're having nice food out there that the bodies or the ashes of the saints are all right there in this beautiful little paradise garden. Right?
Are they in decomposable urns?
No urn at all, just into the ground.
No urn, just mm-hmm. And are there any memories, like, is their name
plaques,
somewhere?
Right, yeah, a plaque that keeps track of everybody. Uh-huh. So just some more images, I want you to see, because you could see the ritual theater here, right? This is the other end of that ritual theater. Even physically carrying a body all the way down to rest in the earth. You can see that South Carolina red dirt there. So now a few reflections on wisdom and this tradition. So when my son was three, before we moved to Holden, we found a dead squirrel in our backyard, and we went to what are we going to do? We're going to bury it. So we bury the squirrel, and as we're preparing to do this, Forrest says, this is kind of like Ash Wednesday, isn't it? And two things that I was struck by, that he was 3 years old, and Ash Wednesday had already worked on him, that he remembered that we are dust, and to dust we shall return, and it gave him a category by which to join his young sense of mortality with the mortality of a fellow creature, a non-human creature. So Ash Wednesday helped Forrest have an epiphany of shared identity across species. That's interesting to me. And then secondly, this kind of remembering that we are dust and we being across the species, what it evoked on his part was compassion. Compassion for a fellow creature. And he wanted to care for this fragile little body. So it reminded me of, I think this is true, like I'm projecting this out now from beyond some little, you know, sweet anecdote about a kid, but this is theologically significant to our tradition. Psalm 103 says, God has compassion on us, for God knows how we were made. God remembers that we are dust. So our scriptural tradition says that this dustiness is related to divine compassion, right? So Ash Wednesday may help us, Ash Wednesday and Ash Wednesday spirituality may evoke compassion. At least so say our scriptures. And in fact, one of the end-of-life midwives that I talked about this year, that I talked to, said in the end, this business of washing and anointing bodies and burying them naturally, the whole thing is about compassion. How do we show compassion for those whom we love? Another wisdom impulse. Oh yeah, this is just what I wanted to say, like that natural burial, what my theory is that it can help us have a sense of compassion for all the other creatures and all the other people. Another image. There's a resonance here with Jesus' words in John's Gospel. Unless a seed falls into the ground and dies, it remains a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And this is one place that I've been encouraged by, the image of natural and especially conservation burial. This image of a seed falling into the ground, you think about most of the way Christianity will, and other traditions will, think about image, what happens to us at death. It's often either up and out of here to a kind of disembodied heaven, or you're simply resting in the ground, or maybe even going to Hades or something, right? So it's unidirectional. And that often gets us into problems, right? You're only getting out of heaven, you're only getting out of earth to go to heaven, or you're going to hell, or just resting in the earth. But this image of a seed that falls into the earth and dies, if you think about its direction, it goes both directions. It grows up into something new and mysterious and bears good fruit, but it also roots down in the earth into that place. It seems to me a kind of a helpful, more complex map of the way, an image we could use for what happens to us at death. And conservation burial does it literally. You're rooting down and you're becoming something new that we say is God's great project of healing the world. Some other kind of wisdom connections. Dorothy Zola, in the book that it's on your bibliography, says kind of profound, death has no place in the landscape of life for those who are pure doers and winners. We live in a landscape where everyone is young and strong, rich, intelligent, and good-looking, or must appear so. The weak, the old, the dying don't count. It's difficult to die in this landscape of winners who manage without memory. So she writes that Sabbath is like a little death from our busyness, and we can, the Sabbath can kind of help us, the Sabbath rest can help us rest in God's grace and not just be simply winners. I'm going to skip over this because I want to get to some conversation. Another thing that I'm interested in, though, is that she says that death, the wisdom tradition theme about how all of us die, she says, might be the very inventor of equality in life. So it's because all of us are going to die, right? That's what wisdom reminds us over and over again. So it's fascinating for me to think of the equality that we know with other creatures at the grave, and that it might be connected to lively present tense calls for equality in life. So if Dorothy Zola is right, this wisdom theme of creaturely equality in death is a functions as a kind of resurrection power in life. So picture it, right? In addition to the ethic of divine compassion, God remembers that we are but dust, Sola says that this has a political implication in the present tense. Here's her quote. I often ask myself whether death is not the very inventor of equality, and whether human beings are permitted any equality at all without the consciousness of death's power. So as death is repressed in the world of the rich, so too the consciousness of human equality disappears. We all know, and we're reminded daily, that there are simply winners and losers. Perhaps the religion of the winners must exclude and repress death as far as possible from their consciousness. Can equality in the negative sense be so neatly distinguished from equality in the positive, revolutionary sense of human rights for all? Okay, a few more images here. This is just one more critique of this that this tradition offers to the powerful. And we may notice from James, right? The sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the field. The flower falls and its beauty perishes. It's the same way with the rich. In the midst of a busy life, they will wither away. Or those of us who are children of the 80s, you remember Don Henley had this a line in one of his songs, you don't see no hearses with luggage racks, right? So it's this critique on the acquisition of wealth and power. So remembering that we are dust and to dust we shall return is a practice of wisdom. Right? And so Ash Wednesday's wisdom traces a cross on us each year, and it points back to us being formed out of earth in the breath of God, and it points forward to the fire of cremation or the earth of our burial, where we will rest in God and in the earth. So as we talked about in that very first wisdom session, this can actually evoke wonder on our part for what it is the arc of our life. Right?
Can you say that one more time, Ben?
Oh, gosh. Ash Wednesday sends us back to our origins in being shaped from the earth and the breath of God. And it also sends us forward to eventually our return to God through the fire of cremation or to rest in the earth and in God in burial. And that arc, right, the wisdom tradition says there's wonder there. We do well to contemplate that. And what it may do is help us move out of that all caps panic mode about death. That this is who we are, and God has shaped us in the beginning and holds us in the end as well. It's that, it's what's there in Psalm 90. So teach us to number our days, not so that we have panic, so teach us to number our days that we may commit our hearts to wisdom. Ash Wednesday, one of the other images I love, St. Augustine in his confession calls our bodies the earth we carry, right? And for a little while, earth gets scooped up and can read a book, can climb to Heart Lake, can surf a wave, can surf the internet, watch a video before we return to the dust of the earth again. So this mortality on Ash Wednesday may summon us into kind of a sense of joy and wonder about while our bodies have any kind of ability, an amazement about that, a radical amazement. And these are images of dawn in Chicago, and I thought about our urban context, and especially like all the African-American churches in Chicago, and one of the pieties among African-American Christianity, you've probably heard this, this prayer before, if it's not a piety of yours. Every morning, treating every morning as a gift, is like a little resurrection. So you probably have heard this in church at some time. We give you thanks, O God, for waking us up this morning. We want to thank you for waking us up in time and not in eternity, so that our bed was not our cooling board and our covers were not our winding sheet. We want to thank you this morning for articulation of speech and the blood that still runs warm in our veins, right? So in many of our communities, right, work is just like trying to stay alive on an everyday basis. And so especially in those communities that have been pushed to the margins of our societies, there's this amazing piety of every day, treating it as a wonder of resurrection beforehand. So the psalmist says we find wisdom in contemplating our mortality. And I hope what you've seen today and over these previous two sessions that, among other things, this scriptural tradition about mortality is calling us to the wisdom of the earth and the wisdom of the earth in all its wildness. And I think in many ways, you've heard that. Like Holden, you're here at Holden Village. You didn't get here by accident. So the call of wisdom from the wilderness and this place's charism of teaching and learning, learning with each other new ideas. This place is a place of kind of wild wisdom, right? I hope that these presentations have been able to help you a bit in your own journey of piecing together God's wild wisdom for you. And I'd like to, can we sing a song before we wrap up and maybe have a chance to talk? Okay? Because I think this one sums up a lot of the theology. And this is by Herman Stumpf. You know, it's about mortality, and it's got this kind of beautifully vigorous, lively sense to it. King's Folded. Da da dum dum da da dum da 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 dum da da dum da. Real lively, but we're going to talk about death. So here we go. Four verses. Each one I'll bring up.
How small our span of life, O God, our years from birth till death. A single beat within the heart, the catching of a breath. A drop within the ocean's deep, a rain upon the shore. A flash of light before we sleep, to see the sun no more. And yet our stack of life is set by your infinity. Our tick of time on earth is caught in your eternity. While suns and stars spin endlessly through depths of cosmic space, while eons roll and ages pass, you hold us in your grace. O Christ, you left eternity to plunge in time's swift stream, to share the shortness of our span, our mortal lives redeem. You filled your cross closed years with love, you loved us to the end, and touch us with your risen life that ours may time transcend. We thank you, God, for kindling faith that lights our transient years, illumining our pilgrimage through mists of doubt and fear. For hope that sees a life beyond the swiftly passing days. For love both human and divine that lifts our hearts to praise.
Isn't that a stunning hymn? Well, we've still got a few minutes that we could have good conversation here. I've kind of tried to, it's one of those things you love so much you got too much to share. But I'd love to hear questions or contestations or ideas.
So how realistic would it be for someone to take 40 acres in northern Minnesota and make it into one of those reserve burial growing places?
Yeah. It's quite doable, and there are a number of places on the bibliography where you can go to kind of get the best help. I'd start with final rites and look around what Slocum and, oh, what's her name? Josh Slocum and?
Slocum and Carlson.
Carlson, yes. Lisa Carlson. They're some of the people who are your biggest advocates and allies who can help you with that. Mm-hmm. And usually the way that that might work would be to start with a land trust, which is kind of easy to do, mm-hmm. And then you can work from there. It varies state by state, and that final rights book would give you some good places to start. Amazingly, like if it's your farmland already, in almost every state, it's just fine for you to bury somebody there. There's nothing against it. You got to watch, how you file paperwork and.
Yeah, a concern that's been spoken among our family for doing that is who wants to buy land with someone buried on it?
Right, yeah.
Say it again.
Who wants to buy land with someone buried on it? And I'm like, it's sacred ground.
And guess what? All ground has, right?
Who cares if you're dead anyway?
Right. But this is, I would want to flag this. I've been watching this. I don't know if I've seen too many studies on this, but a lot of the churches that I work with or people who are interested in this, even a church that's in a residential area that's really set widely apart from houses around there, when they've been putting it, we're going to put in a columbarium that's not even going to be visible from the road. Sometimes the neighbors have heard about this and really worked against it. And I think it has something to do with this kind of American denial of death and being spooked out about it, wanting it not to be contagious to us. Those of us who have traveled through other countries, Europe and places, you're not going to miss death. Right? It's embedded in the landscape. So some of that is about neighbors, right?
What do you know about the, if somebody wants a cemetery like this, I think it's difficult to find.
Yeah, I have a list of all the green burials cemeteries in the United States up till at least a few months ago. If you email me, I'll get it to you at least in a 3 weeks from now, because I won't be home for a while, but I'd be happy to send it to you. But you can start with the Green Burial Council, and that will give you a lot of providers near you. Not all of them are certified through the Green Burial Council, but the number of them is growing really rapidly.
Imagine it's on their website.
Yeah, the ones that are certified, yes, but there's probably at least that many, again, that aren't certified by them. The other thing you can do, in already established cemeteries, if you go in ahead of time and I've got, I think Slocum and Carlson might have that. If you just ask people, basically hey, I understand you want to be able to mow here. I'd like to be buried without a vault. If I paid you $500 extra to mound that up and just care for that, would that be okay? Because it usually is just cemetery policy. So you don't assume that you can't work with people.
You're kind of backlit over here, so I can't see your face. And I shared this with you at a meal, but my father was killed in a plane accident in 1976. I was 13. And he had always told my mother that he wanted to be buried in a plain pine box, not knowing he was going to die tragically young. But so she just started asking, his friends. He was a pastor in a small town, so it was traumatic for the town and for the parish too. But so they found out he was buried in Washington because our family farm is on Camino Island in the Puget Sound. But my mom was very surprised that the only regulation for the state or the cemetery was just that it had to be buried at a certain depth. So my father's friends created a plan and built the structural pieces, and I thought I could talk without crying. That's okay. And so then his friends, he was in a plane accident. So in fact, he had flown that day to show a friend Holden Village. They had flown around Holden Village and had radioed home from Wenatchee and crashed on the way back. But anyway, so they put what was left of the body, I don't know what condition was, into the pine box and put down the functional nails. And then it sat available in this garage, and people were invited as they wanted to for the next 24 hours to come and pound nails in the lid. So our whole family participated in that. So we have some pictures of, my little brother tapping the hammer. It's quite, but, and then a friend of his, a private pilot buddy, flew it, the body up to Camino Island in his plane. And then, so he was buried, but, and just put right into the earth. There was no vault. So, and that was just starting out like, well, he had told me this is what he wanted. Why don't we just call around and see if it's legal?
Yeah.
And it was. Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, thank you for being brave to share.
Yeah,
that.
And it wasn't called Green Barrier.
Right. It was just an area.
In fact, it wasn't until I was sitting there talking, I was like, maybe my dad's was a Green Barrier. But he just always said he wanted the worms to get him. That he was, that's what he wanted to do. So,
what's one of the things that's so beautiful about that in such an awful, like tragic and unexpected death, right? Is that we feel so powerless, and we still are. Like, there's no taking away the awfulness of a death, an unnatural early death, and yet people were able to carry him. That those nails, that's about compassion and care. Let me tuck you in.
And the person whose house it was in said that they heard people coming and going all through the night, that they would suddenly hear pounding coming in. And it was, for them, kind of a ritual of care and healing as well. And so it was really beautiful for how tragic it was.
This, in these natural burial grounds, especially the conservation burial grounds, tragic deaths, early deaths, are overrepresented. Actually, and the way I've thought about it is there's so much beauty and life there, and in some ways it's like taking all this beauty and life and throwing it in death's face. Like, this has been so awful, we're going to somehow seek a way that the imagery of this death is going to be beautiful and full of life that we loved for this person.
So you opened the door to this. Where's Beth on all this stuff?
Oh, she's down with it, yeah.
She's just down with
it. So she's not going to stand in your way?
No.
So my experiences have been the antithesis. And I remember a woman who was in her 90s very impressed because the vault came with a lifetime guarantee.
Oh.
We also started out of the church to take me out to the vault.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So there's a little kind of the American Memorial Service traditions finding their way.
Well, when she asks, it's hard to say no.
Ben, up here. So,
yes.
Long story, I'll make it short, but we have a friend in Minneapolis who built a casket for a family member, and it spread. So over the next 4 years, he had many, many requests to build this green casket, which I didn't know what all this was when he was talking about it 8 years ago. And he got a letter in the mail from the Minneapolis, whatever, Mortician Society, and said that he was, not compliant, or he was whatever. And so he looked into it, and there was nothing that said you can't do this, but he just decided, and he was a little bit of a conspiracy theorist, and was just trying to do what he felt was right, and then he decided to go to more mortuary school.
Wow.
And was really wanting to infiltrate legitimately, some of the thinking. But I wondered from your perspective, and there's a lot more to that story, but how So, I mean, his thing is that it's all a profit. There, he was cutting into money and that people were earning by creating simple burials and all these things. And but is there an integration? I mean, so you have the like everything polarized,
yeah.
The green and the
right.
You know, everybody in between. But is it being more integrated into, or are you hearing more about it?
Yeah, two things I'd say. Yeah, it's hard to make a living doing mortuary care, and that's true for all of those death care professionals. So there's that, and a lot of people, like the people who are doing the conservation burial grounds, said we need a way to make this financially sustainable for the people who are caring for the forests and doing this work. Another thing I would lift up is that some natural burial stuff goes super like producty. So you've probably seen like the mushroom suit. Have you seen this?
Yes.
They've done tests. It just doesn't do anything. But like it's this thing that's impregnated supposedly with like specially chosen spores that will decontaminate your body under the ground. It's an expensive suit, but it's a natural burial product, right? And then you know there's the big. They're beautiful. These you kind of go into a fetal position and you become like this. It's like a big seed pod that becomes a tree. But laying our bodies in the earth still works. It's hard for somebody to make a profit off of that.
Mm.
Yeah. So one of the things I've seen is municipal burial grounds, whereas cities and villages have already a cemetery. I saw one place where a daughter of the town trustee gave a presentation that she had given in high school to them and said, we should become a green funeral or a green cemetery. They said yes, and it was so popular they bought more land to put into preservation. I saw Roy up here, and then we got a
nonprofit. Oh, I grew up in a country church between Clark City and Rebel in South Dakota, and the cemetery is still there, and the church bell is not only on a concrete slab, but next to the cemetery plot, my grandparents are buried there, and my parents are buried a little further away, but there's a single pine tree growing next to my grandparents.
Wow.
My dad would kind of, in a sort of a rabbinic fashion, I heard him ask about 6-8 times when I was growing up, you know why the pine tree is so tall? And we would all answered, no, why is it? And then he said, well, the roots grow down into the caskets and get their food from bodies. I thought, that's pretty cool, and pine trees and standing strong as well.
Yes, yes.
Really quickly,
yeah.
I just want to say that you during the time when we thought that Holden might find its death by fire, I went to a worship service to kind of like hold him from afar. And I remember so many people saying, it's okay, because even if we lose Holden, the spirit of Holden will be kept alive in the wider community of Holden.
Mm.
And that really grated against my own like pre-grief. We didn't end up having to grieve this physical space.
Yeah.
But like but I remember thinking, but the smell of the pool hall, or like the smell of praying at fireside, or those pine trees that that I've walked under, right?
Yeah.
And like the physical body of holding also is valuable.
Yeah.
And it's not just the kind of spirit of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is that's this kind of American idea, right?
Right.
We'll whisk the body away
and
speak only of the spirit living. Now, I don't want to critique, there are ways that we need to cope with death, and we do what we can, right?
Certainly.
But what you're saying for you, and that's contemplating that, contemplating the body and its wounds and your love for it, and wanting it to be healthy and whole and not dismissed, right? That would have been part of your grieving. It would have been important not to skip over it.
Exactly,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it is interesting when you start to think about
if it's a your own child that you've raised and cared for and combed their hair and washed their face, and suddenly at death you wouldn't do that. That seems unusual, right? That one more, let me wash their face, let me carry them to the grave. As devastating as that is, it's an act of compassion. Ooh. Thank you, everyone, for sharing this stuff. And thanks for being careful with each other. We are creatures, we are resurrection creatures, but we're also creatures of, like, the grass. And we have to be gentle with each other in this. And we're all, in one way or the other, mortality is never far away from us. I know in our families or in our other relationships. So let's go pray around the cross together.